wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
San Diego station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned baby.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what gets
us. Is he there?
Virginity at the same time.
Kindness, right? And
weight
pressures.
News Goop.
What we need to know.
News Goop.
What we want to know.
We got News Goop.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor. News Goop.
What we need to know.
News Goop.
What we want to know.
We got News Goop.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we...
On the one hand, there's the public's right to know. On the other hand...
Thank you. Hey, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio, a news dissector radio on PRN FM. We do this program every week to try to talk about what's happening in the media and to the media with invited guests of all kinds. And today, we're very pleased to have a very special guest with us. We want to welcome Dr. Marwan Beshara, Al Jazeera's senior political analyst and host of Empire, a very lively and insightful program which is available online in the United States. He was previously a professor of international relations at the American University of Paris and a fellow in another university there. He's the author of Palestine, Israel, Peace or Apartheid, and The Invisible Arab, The Promise and Peril of the Arab Revolutions. He writes and speaks extensively on global politics and is widely regarded as a leading authority on many of today's most relevant global issues, U.S. foreign policy, and the growing Middle East crisis. His writing has been in a whole bunch of newspapers, and he is, you know, a senior political analyst of a major network that many Americans are just discovering. Welcome, Marwan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Danny.
Marwan, maybe we should start with you telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and your interest in politics and how your interest in media and news was shaped.
Well, like most students of international affairs, I've done my bits between the United States and France, earning my doctorate in political sociology and ended up teaching, as you mentioned earlier. But somehow, because of the urgency of most of these issues we talk about in international relations, I somehow for years had one foot in academia and one foot in the media, writing since 20-some years in the International Herald Tribune, which now became the New York Times International, as well as a number of European publications like Le Monde, and you know, more of the same situation every year or so. We had a crisis in the region since the first Gulf War in 1991, you know, through 9/11 and on to the war against Iraq in 2003, and so on and so forth. So many crises in the process. So It was a bit interesting for me and for many to be able to use our academic constructs and concepts in order to better understand those complex political situations that the media covers most of the time, to do it in a way that goes beyond the wire services, do it in a way that takes in consideration geopolitical contexts and historical contexts.
Was it a challenge for you to move from a print medium, writing essays, which you still do for Al Jazeera, to a television environment? where you suddenly you become a personality, suddenly you become very conscious of your presentation skills as well as your information skills. Has that been a transition for you? I went from radio to television, and also I've, you know, been writing in print ever since. So
right.
You know, I know the differences of each medium, but what has that meant for you?
Well, actually, I have been for a long time on television. I've always been asked to comment on various political situations. Before Al Jazeera, I was the senior political analyst for another Gulf-based television that covered the second Gulf War in 2003 in a major way, probably more than most others networks. And before that, of course, you know, did my rounds in BBC and TV5 and all these other television stations. But primarily, Danny, I would say the following. The major transition was from speaking to 20 or 30 students to speaking to 20 or 30 million viewers. And that is kind of paradoxical because in a way, when you have 20 or 30 pairs of eyes looking at you during 2-3 hours of a seminar at the university, you tend to, you know, shape up and be prepared and so on and so forth, but you don't somehow subconsciously don't pay attention to the fact that you're talking to 20 million people, because what does that even mean, talking to so many people around the world? And do it no longer in our longer academic formats, but have to summarize very complex ideas in sound bites and in 2-3 minutes. That was a challenge.
Well, as you may know, I did a film called WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, mm-hmm. about the coverage of the Gulf War, and I covered Al Jazeera as well as the American television networks. I basically felt it was a media war, and I tried to show the different ways that media war was presented to the mm-hmm. public with very sharp differences. Al Jazeera was much more concerned with what was happening to the people on the ground, whereas the United States was mostly concerned with, you know, strategy, its perception in the world, its sense of global mission, you know, us against them, the evildoers, and the like. And I was very impressed with Al Jazeera, because Al Jazeera also had a commitment, even though Americans don't seem to know it, to telling the story and the other story. Tell me a little bit about how Al Jazeera developed its approach to covering the world.
Well, it's as simple as finding the best timing in the best of places, where this region is dominated by state media, does not have, at the time, back in 1995 and onward, did not have, in that region, did not have much of a free media anywhere, certainly not satellite television or regional channels and the likes. So in a region that has been at the receiving end of power, at the receiving end of political repression, at the receiving end of occupation and war, there was no medium that spoke to and for the people at the receiving end of power. And from then on, Al Jazeera took advantage of the fact that there was such a high popularity for its approach, because people were thirsty for the kind of coverage, for the kind of discussions that were available to Arab viewers. At the time, it used to be the Arab Network, of course, in the beginning, that later on in 2006 became also in English for the Al Jazeera English. But back then, between 1995 and 1996 and 2006, in the first 10 years, the possibility to debate and the originality of the coverage in a new and free way, free from state-sponsored and free from Western intervention, that kind of a medium that became Al Jazeera became so popular that even when it introduced new voices, for example, introducing Israeli voices to the Arab stratosphere, that was revolutionary in every means, because before Al Jazeera came on, not a single Israeli politician would be, or commentator, or Israeli citizen would ever be heard by an Arab channel. But Al Jazeera was dedicated and committed to the kind of free speech and free debate, and what the slogan used to be, the opinion and the other opinion. allowed for that to happen, and that made it stronger and made it more popular and became the voice of the voices, what we see, which in other words means it was no longer state-controlled or power-controlled or in our case here, corporate control, but it is one that speaks for the citizens as the fourth estate is supposed to.
At the same time, the U.S. reaction, officially anyway, to Al Jazeera was to confuse Al Jazeera with Al-Qaeda, to suggest mm-hmm. that this was terrorist TV. I know this must have been very frustrating to people at Al Jazeera who were attempting to offer the opinion and the other opinion and having them characterized as a propaganda outlet for terrorism.
Well, you know, some of us with a slightly longer memory, and it would be great just to try to put that in the context of American position towards Al Jazeera, even the official one at the time. The State Department and various spokespersons in Washington were quite praising of Al Jazeera between 1995 and 1998 when we first covered the American bombing of Afghanistan at the time. That's when things started going wrong, is because when we were talking about the Arab world and Arab issues, Washington was quite complimentary about it, saying that here it is, a free forum for debate and discussions, and that even Israelis are, you know, allowed there, and Americans, and so on and so forth. So it was pretty huge. It's only when Al Jazeera started showing the pictures of dead Afghanis from 1998 onwards, and later on dead Sudanese and so on and so forth from the various American strikes, and of course the 2000 Israeli response to the Palestinian Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. And from then on, 1998 to 2000, the hostility in the United States and Israel towards Al Jazeera, it grew exponentially because this was the only network that would expose and that would broadcast images of war that have not been seen before. So when we came to 2001 and 9/11, the situation was ripe for hostility towards Al Jazeera as the network who covers the issues from the receiving end of power, not from the center of power. Now, I know I'm giving you these long answers, but just allow me one last statement on that, one last comment on that. What's surprising, Danny, is that not just in America, but throughout the world, the English-speaking networks from CNN on Fox to NBC onto BBC and TV5 and Russia Today and so on, all of them come from the centers of power, centers of global power. The only English-speaking network that comes from the receiving end of power and does not represent a center of power, you know, per se, is Al Jazeera. And hence that sets it apart from everyone else, and hence that made it a subject of criticism of its coverage of the post 9/11 affairs.
But it wasn't just criticism. I don't have every detail vivid in my memory, but, you know, Al Jazeera correspondents were bombed, were killed
yes.
By American power and by, you know, in Iraq.
Yes.
This was a situation where there was an attempt, it seems, to silence Al Jazeera or intimidate Al Jazeera.
We've heard it explicitly, actually, by the likes of former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. His attacks on Al Jazeera were severe, and he accused Al Jazeera basically of siding with the enemy, as it were. Even though, at the very same time in 2003, if you remember, Saddam Hussein spokesperson were attacking Al Jazeera for manipulating the Arab and international public opinion, according to Saddam Hussein's spokesman.
Yeah.
So we actually had it bad from both the Iraqis, Saddam Hussein, and from the Rumsfelds of the world. And yes, you're right. In the process, a good number of Al Jazeera since Afghanistan onto Iraq, and by the way, onto Libya, cameramen and journalists and producers have died in the line of duty, as it were, being courageous journalists trying to picture.
And one of your journalists, I mean, I think it's important for Americans particularly to know about this because it wasn't very well covered here, but an Al Jazeera journalist was arrested and put in Guantanamo Bay, suspected but never proven to be a terrorist. Finally, he was released after really being tortured there.
He was actually a cameraman, and his fellow cameraman, which happened to be an American citizen and was with him in the same apartment in Afghanistan forever, was telling me the other day how Sami al-Hajj's name was arrested and sent to Guantanamo, how he was so, you know, your as they would say in America, your average, you know, Joe the plumber. I mean, basically, this was Sami the cameraman. That's it. I mean, it goes as far as that. Sami the cameraman, and there wasn't much to the guy besides that. He was a journalist. He was a cameraman who was working in a war zone. And at the time, it was quite easy during that time of war to have most of these types of people, who Arabs who have darker skin, who happened to work in a war zone, to be, you know, collected and sent out to various camps, including Guantanamo. And of course, there was nothing, he was nothing charged officially of anything, and there was nothing proven on him, and he was eventually sent back.
But to Al Jazeera's credit, and we're seeing this today in Egypt as well, when Al Jazeera personnel have been accused of crimes, you know, by people in power, various people in power today in Cairo, and are being tried or jailed and all the rest of it, Al Jazeera has stood up for them and has mounted international campaigns to free them, as appeal to solidarity from journalists in other countries as well. Are they receiving support from American journalists?
Yes, and that should be noted and should be underlined and should be celebrated, Danny. The fact that American and European and various journalists from around the world and various institutions, media institutions from around the world, have been quite in solidarity with Al Jazeera and have voiced their criticism of the Egyptian authorities for doing that. You could say we have experience in this after 16, 17 years of, you know, having our colleagues arrested in various ways and repressed or even killed, as you stated earlier. And this time around, really, you know, our competitors have come and have pulled together and have spoken in their own networks. You know, I could say people like in CNN and the BBC and so on and so forth have been quite outspoken, MSNBC and the like, against the lack of treatment that Al Jazeera journalists have been facing. And I know these guys who are facing those charges in Egypt, and it's totally and utterly ridiculous, the fact that, you know, our colleagues would be charged with any such you know, criminality when they have been simply doing their work.
Well, I would say, having gone to some Al Jazeera conferences in Doha, you know, where Al Jazeera is based, in Qatar, you know, there were posters, you know, reminding people about the contributions of these people and the fact that they were being detained unfairly and illegally. So I think Al Jazeera has stood up for them. But, you know, fighting against a authoritarian system, or even a heavily ideological system, which I would call our own media in many ways, very ideological. We have a lot of competition, but essential agreement on how issues are framed. So NBC and CBS, ABC, I worked for ABC for 10 years, you know, 8 years, might be competing on a story, but when they get to tell the story, they tell it the same way as all the other networks. Even Fox and CNN tell the stories the same way. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. What are the differences between the Al Jazeera approach to news coverage and the American network approach?
Well, I'll tell you, let's start from the end. I mean, certainly at this point in time, which what I find, to be honest, quite amazing, astounding, and worrying, worrisome at the same time, is the fact that, you know, after years of, for example, fighting in Iraq, and while there's still a number of contractors and so on and so forth in Iraq, that not one American network has a bureau in Iraq, and in fact, not one of them have a correspondent in Iraq. So here's a country that Americans fought and Americans died, and in the process, so many Iraqis died, and now not one network
been there, done that. Let's move on.
But how could you move on after, you know, a country has been more or less destroyed? It's the fabric of its society, in total chaos, and people continue to die every day. Tens of people are dying there every week, again, from violence left out from the war. Look at Afghanistan. Until there was started to have some discussion about, you know, the final pullout and agreement, and Joe Biden and the vice president went there, I will remind your listeners to go and look, to Google it. There was not a single report from Afghanistan where there were 55,000 American soldiers. So how could you cover, how could you frame, how could you have, you know, a comprehensive perspective on these issues that concern Americans and non-Americans, concern the world, when you don't have presence?
Do you see our media in a way as being a propaganda system? This is the critique of Noam Chomsky and others who say that the United States is very selective in how it covers American foreign policy and, of course, marginalizes critics of American foreign policy.
Well, look, I think mainstream media in this country, like in other Western countries, tend to... whether deliberately or otherwise, and I would argue that it's not necessarily always deliberately, it just comes naturally to them to speak the language of power. When you are in Paris, London, Berlin, or Washington, New York, you tend to speak the language of power. You are no longer speaking from the angle of those at the receiving end of power. And here, this also, you know, has a certain dimension to it, which I find also problematic, which is the whole idea of patriotism, as if to mystify certain issues makes you more patriotic, as if telling the truth is unpatriotic, as if reporting the facts is unpatriotic. I think the most patriotic thing ever for any media is to be able to speak truth to power and to be able to report the facts to the citizens.
Yeah, but see, what are facts? I mean, we seem to be much more in the perception business than the fact-sharing business. We're reinforcing, to some degree, a narrative that's already sort of been decided. And a lot of the stories tend to reflect that by the choice of who they interview and who they don't interview, by the choice of how they frame the story and how they don't frame the story. So the perspective tends to be fairly parochial in many ways and self-interested without explicitly admitting so.
I actually noticed that, and that's the difference not just with Al Jazeera, it's actually the difference with European television networks. When you listen to an interview on BBC, for example, or other British networks with an official, be that a British or American, you tend to hear questioning, and you're trying, a journalist trying to get to the bottom of issues. I think here, from everything I've seen, whether it's the Sunday talk shows or, you know, the usual celebrity anchors on the American networks, they tend to be complicit almost sometimes with their interviewee, and that's why all these officials and politicians like to get on these programs, because they never ask the hard questions, always softball. And it's always a bit of a, you know, explain to us, tell us, rather than, you know, why and how are you doing these things and so on. So there is a sense of a complicity. There's a sense that media and power are on the same side of issues, when media is supposed to be siding with the citizens and questioning power.
But media is also a business, Marwan, as you are well aware. Mm-hmm. And is it difficult or different? For example, here you have Al Jazeera America now, AJAM is how their nickname, okay? Working in an environment where it seems as if there has to be some softening of opinions in news, where there's a more featureish orientation. Is there a danger that the Al Jazeera mission can be compromised just by the cultural framework here and the commercial framework that you're competing in?
You know, there are always dangers and there are always mistakes and, you know, there are always failures in any network or in any institutions, demarch. We're all capable of making mistakes, especially when we enter new markets. But I think the mission for Al Jazeera remains the same. And I think even if sometimes, we're giving, perhaps not the very, original version of what it is we do, and we try to adapt to new markets, I think in the end of the day, what is clear is that the American people, the American viewer, expect from media to be able to report the facts and to question power. And that's why, in my view, people are turning away from cable news in droves over the last few years, because people are tired of watching and listening and not understanding what is going on. I think there is there's now a tendency among a lot of networks to move towards more studio discussion and reality TV, if you will, covering mysteries and so on and so forth, rather than to be able to report the facts as they should. But in the end of the day, I think what is needed in this market, if you want to call it that way, the media market, what is required by the American public opinion, which I think is one of the more, especially in its elites, some of the most intelligent, most worldly in the world, they're going to be demanding of Al Jazeera to be more worldly, to report the facts from the rest of the world, as well as from America, and to be able to provide that kind of robust, bold journalism that Americans aspire for.
Well, there have been sort of kind of tepid response to Al Jazeera from some of your competitors. Obviously, they mm-hmm. would prefer that Al Jazeera not be there at all, offering any kind of alternative. And they're now sort of saying, well, Al Jazeera only has 15,000 viewers. It's not catching on. Of course, you don't have equal access to all of the market, all the media markets in America. It's been a big uphill battle that's taken some 10 years to just get on the air, plus a lot of money to get on Time Warner Cable, which is, of course, being sold now to a more conservative company. I don't know what the future will be there. Is this something... is the morale within Al Jazeera high? I mean, I know that there have been some layoffs, and is it there a positive view of the prospects here, or... because we're getting a lot of negative information.
Look, I think this is the beginning, and in the beginning, you put together a network, and I think this network, Al Jazeera America, was put together in a record time. Beyond that, everything else now should continue on a different mode than in the mode of starting up something or putting it together. At this point in time, we need to move towards the kind of journalism we've always aspired to do in the United States, which is, again, it's reporting the facts and questioning power in a way that serves, American citizen, just as we do it in a way that serves the global citizen. I think if we go down that way, we will find that our viewership will triple and quadruple in no time, and eventually this will be the place where an American who wants to know more about what's going on in the world beyond a mystery of a plane will find Al Jazeera to be the place.
Well, as I found out working at ABC, there's a lot of conventional wisdom that is dominant in the executive suites. Essentially, a perspective that the people really don't want to know any more than we're giving them. I tell a story in a book I've just written about a story at NBC News where a journalist in South Africa had done a story about the educational challenges there, and the executive producer said, no, who's interested in this? Nobody's going to want to watch this. If you can show me a housewife in Queens who's interested in this story, I'll run it. Well, it just so happened there was an intern at the network in that year. He says, well, my mother lives in Queens. Maybe she'd come. Let's see what she thinks. So they brought his mother into the studio to see the rough cut of this story. And she said, oh, it's very interesting. It's about children. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And NBC, after doing the housewife test, ran the story. But, you don't have the same hesitancy about running trivia, celebrity stories, mindless features, and all the rest of it. When it came to something about another country where people were struggling to improve their lives after years of apartheid, etc., and so forth in South Africa, there was suddenly, you know, prove it to me as an attitude that, that there's any interest at all, which, of course, there was interest in it.
You know, I think cable news is a different animal altogether. I think a news 24-hour news organization, you know, should not expect to be, competing with the mainstream networks in the sense of it's not exactly providing drama or series or entertainment and the likes. And I don't expect every, you know, Sarah and Joe to be wanting to watch cable news all the time. Sometimes even the cable networks work on the assumption that, you know, that the particular couple might watch half an hour or 1 hour of the day, which is fine. Because, you know, the whole idea of having 24-hour news is also a recent animal. We didn't have that 20 years ago. So this is all new, and it's not necessarily made for every possible person in the country. And sometimes these are meant for, you know, smaller audiences than the usual mainstream television. That's the nature of it. And that's why it costs less to run it than it does on the other things, especially with, you know, the wire service and everything else that's available. Now, having said that, I'm not sure if we're all running into some sort of a popularity contest or not, because at the end of the day, I think what's important is not just to poll people and to feed them what they want. In that case, maybe they should go into car dealerships or something. If you want to report the news, you need to report the news. And you don't report the news according to the taste of the different people. It's not.
That's the justification, Marwan,
of
the heroin dealer. You know, we're only giving people what they want. Marwan, there was important developments today in the Israel-Palestine peace deals. I know you've written about this, and we really would like to get your perspective on some of the issues you have covered and some of the views you've come to have about them. Could you stay with us for a few minutes? We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with you. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay.
Come all you good workers and all you dispossessed. The perps are not in prison, nobody has confessed. I say, which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
Now, ready to go back on?
Which side are you on, girl? Which side are you on? My daddy was
okay.
A banker, but I'm not a banker's son. Cause I refuse to profit from the pain.
And this is Danny Schechter, your news dissector, back with Media Channel Radio. And we're speaking with, and welcome back, Dr. Marwan Bashara, Al Jazeera's senior political analyst and the host of Empire. Tell us a little bit about Empire before we get into some of these issues. It's a program that you've been identified with, and yet it's not on the air here. It is online, though.
It is online. It was geo-blocked, as it's called here. Meaning it was not allowed for a while, for several months, but now we're back online and we're very happy with that because it's the kind of program that needs to be viewed not just today and tomorrow on a TV network, but it's the kind of thing that people need to take the time and maybe eventually at any point in time can be able to look it up at aljazeera.com/empire, which is where all the episodes of the last 5-6 years are on. Our last one was on, of course, the United States, Russia, and Ukraine, where we don't give anyone a break, and we don't actually treat it from any one particular perspective. And this one is coming out on Sunday. It's going to be the first foreign media debate that takes place in Havana and Washington. So we have an hour of debate and storytelling between Havana and Miami and Washington on American, Cuban, and Latin American relations. And all of that's going to be now available on the web, and that's a great thing. The way we cover these issues, as I said, Russia, the United States, and the Ukraine, as it is in Cuba, Latin America, and the United States, is that Empire is a different genre of a program that covers issues that have strategic, transnational, and global in nature. So we try to go beyond the micro to the macro issues that affect so many people around the world, so many of us. And because the program is based in New York, there's a lot of emphasis, of course, also on American role around the world and how America is viewed overseas as much as it, how it affects events overseas.
Well, here in the Empire, Marwan, we need a program like this. And again, at aljazeera.com/empire, you can check this out. We played some excerpts last week. And, you know, it's a very, you know, compelling and informative program. So congratulations on that. Now, on to some of the issues. You know, the world is now uncertain about what's going to happen in Ukraine. There's a mounting conflict. Some have said a second Cold War between Russia and the United States. There's a lot of hostility. There's a lot of different issues in the coverage. The New York Times apparently has now apologized for running some photographs that it inaccurately described as Russian soldiers. There's a lot of discussion and concern about it. What take did you take on Empire about this crisis?
I think the United States and Russia, you know, continue to have residual problems, if you will, from the good old times of the Cold War. And I think Russia, from its perspective, reckons that the Western encroachment on its borders, on its security, and on its neighbors continue and has continued for the last 20 years. And that it needs to put an end to it, especially when it connects its very immediate surroundings, those surroundings that the Russians have warned NATO over the years that it should, over the United States, that they should not really come so close to its borders. Of course, from Washington, the perspective is that Putin is restless, and Russia is trying to regain its old empire and prestige and so on and so forth, and one way to do it is through its Russian minorities in the Ukraine, Moldavia, and other places in order to reinvent the Soviet Union, if you will, in a new way. And everyone tends to cite in Washington Putin saying that one of the most disastrous developments in the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union. What they don't add is what he said after that, which is, and it would be a folly to try to reinstitute it. Meaning Russia is not, as far as Putin is concerned anyway, interested in reinventing the Soviet Union. Now, one last comment on that, and that's the bit that annoys me the most, and we try to debate it on Empire, is the fact that while there are differences and challenges and perhaps even, you know, tensions escalating to violence in the Ukraine between the West and Russia and between the Ukrainians themselves, this does not qualify to a new Cold War, because Cold War was not just a conflict over a neighbor. It was not simply a tension between two states like Russia and the United States. It was a clash between two visions over the world and its future. It was between communism and Western capitalism. It was a Cold War that had the biggest buildup in human history in Europe, and some of the hottest conflicts and wars by proxy in the developing world. That, all, of course, fused with the threat of nuclear holocaust, all of that was available, and all of that is not returning today. So there is no return to the Cold War, but there is a crisis that needs to be taken seriously, and perhaps more diplomatically than in another way.
Well, there is also an economic dimension to this, which doesn't tend to get covered very well in the blow-by-blow political reporting that takes place, particularly the United States encouraging the Ukrainians to adopt fracking technologies, which are very controversial here in the United States. There's a lot of investment in natural gas and a desire for Ukraine's natural gas. So, you know, there are resources here. There are interests here, not just issues.
You know, I think, of course, in every situation, there are various dimensions to it. I think here, in this very particular case, the strategic imperative tends to overcome or others, including for Russia, for example, not just for the United States. I mean, it's clear that on the short term, whether it's Crimea or whether it is the residuals of any possible sanctions by the West against Russia, I think Russia could, at least on the intermediate run, come out economically a loser from this thing. But for Moscow, the main priority is strategic, not economic, and hence the all other interests, including the economic one, tends to take the backseat to, you know, the primary nationalistic or, in this case, strategic imperative. The fact that Russia might expand or Russia might, you know, reawaken and be reckoning with Europe and vice versa is something, you know, of a major concern for those who still think in Cold War terms.
Marwan, you've written two books about the Middle East. Just today, Israel announced that they're ending the negotiations with the Palestinians. It's not clear they ever started them, but they're claiming that because the two movements of Palestinians, of Fatah and Hamas, have somehow gotten together or want to get together and have reconciled, that's a pretext or reason to stop peace talks. And they've stopped it, and the United States has, according to reports I've read, supported what Israel has done. This is after all these months of quiet or not so quiet diplomacy by John Kerry, the Secretary of State. You know this issue very well. You live it in your life, and you're aware of all the different factors and forces here. Tell us what your take is on all of this. Is this the end of the road once again for peace in the Middle East?
Well, you know, it has been. It has been called that way many times, but it's somehow Washington tends to resurrect it, you know, after each and every blow over the last 20 years. So a process that started basically in 1991 and took a, you know, a big push in 1993 between Palestinians and Israelis has been failing successfully now for two decades. And why do I say failing successfully? Because they tend to sign agreements and enter into countless discussions and different auspices in different capitals, always under the sponsorship of the United States, but really nothing tangible happens. Once you take out the title peace process and look sort of in a very focused way on what just happened over the last 20 years during this process, you'll find out that this was a war process, basically the continuation of occupation through other means. And this is not an opinion per se. I mean, my opinions are, I'll keep them to myself at times, but analytically speaking, the number of, for example, illegal Jewish settlers in the internationally recognized occupied territories have tripled and quadrupled during those very same negotiation years that were supposed to lead to two-state solutions between Palestinians and Israel. So the very issue of ridding both the Palestinians and Israelis from occupation has failed, and what instead has been instituted over there is the continuation of occupation and the controlling of one people over another people for the last 20 years. So for those of us who are truly interested in peace, we should be rejoicing that the peace process ended. Because the peace process, from an analytical point of view, has been a major blow to serious attempts at peace in the Middle East. What the peace process has brought about is a forum of sorts whereby a new regional order after the Cold War was possible under the sponsorship of the United States. So for Washington, it was, you know, good and dandy for 20 years to be the sponsor of the central negotiations process between Israel and the Arabs, and especially between Israel and the Palestinians. But in real terms, there was so much process and so little peace in this peace process that the Palestinians continue to live under occupation. The Palestinians continue to suffer from the encroachment of illegal settlements. The Palestinians continue to suffer from terrible economic conditions, from dispossession, in refugee camps, And there are some number over 3.5 million already among them. So none of these important issues have been resolved. And by on the same hand, I think Israeli insecurities or Israeli insecurities have increased, have not decreased over the last 20 years. Why? Because the situation has not improved.
But Israel presents itself very forcefully in the media here, and certainly in the Jewish community here, and you've written about this, as the victim. The victim of terrorism, the victim of unreasonable, demands by Palestinians, the victim of a historical process where the whole Arab world is against them. All of this tends to fly in the face of realities that are rarely reported in our media. So if you're just kind of checking on the perceptions of things, maybe it sounds reasonable. You know, we've stopped the negotiations because terrorists, we don't negotiate with terrorists, so whatever. We've defined them as terrorists, okay? So isn't this a problem that the people who rely on television, rely on the media for our understanding of these events get such a contested view of it with a very little factual basis?
Look, the ideological constraint over the discussion in this country on this question has been enormous. I mean, it's very difficult here to speak of in an egalitarian way, if you will, between Israelis and Palestinians, even though it's the Israelis, of course, that occupy Palestinian land and not vice versa. So the idea that you can tackle this issue from a perspective of an occupation that has been going on for over four decades has taken the backseat to the whole idea of a peace process. So in terms of conceptualization, we've entered into a logic of negotiation and diplomacy, putting aside or almost demystifying the idea that occupation, illegal military occupation, continues. And I think this is the biggest problem of all problems, is that if this was negotiations between two sovereign states, and it just goes on and they have disputed territories, you could understand. But when this is one nation occupying another nation for decades, and we're still looking at it as if there is a symmetrical situation between them, that means we're not doing our job as media. Because at the end of the day, reporting the facts is reporting the facts of occupation. Reporting the facts will be reporting the facts that there is illegal settlements going on, even according to the United States' own position, twice voting in the UN Security Council, that the Fourth Geneva Convention applies in the occupied territories and hence settlements are illegal. So the United States took the position officially that these settlements are either unhelpful, illegitimate, do not help, peace and so on and so forth, but they continue. So as one Israeli scholar said, how could you continue to discuss sharing a pizza with one side is eating it away?
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. But again, the reasons for this, is it because of bias against Palestinians? Is it because of the Israeli lobby, which is very effective in insinuating its logic, its way of looking at all of these issues into the media frame? Is it because a lack of diversity in the media means that Palestinians or people with another view are excluded from the coverage? What is responsible for this? Because it's not something that's new. This is something that's been consistent.
There are three levels to this conversation of why the media takes the slanted position it does in this country. One is that both the American establishment and the American media for decades have looked at this conflict or at this occupation from the prism of the Cold War, where Israel is seen as a strategic ally of the United States, and the rest were the enemies. Certainly my friend's enemy is my enemy. So in a sense, Israel's enemies were also America's enemies and vice versa. So the Palestinians have been seen throughout the Cold War as enemies of Israel and enemies of the United States in the context of that particular ideological, worldly conflict with at the time, of course, Soviet Union and so on and so forth. Not that the Palestinians were communists or anything or sided with the Soviet Union per se, but still, they were seen in the context or the prism of the Cold War. And that, of course, was a major disadvantage. And then second, in the whole context of the sensitivity towards the Islamic world after 9/11 especially, but also before, the approach towards Islam and the Arabs was also problematic because they were seen as a threat, they were seen as a menace, and later on after 9/11, of course, they were seen or compared or associated with terrorism and the likes, and that's also, you know, made it quite a problem for the Palestinians. And third and last, I think the strong emotional relations by a majority of Jewish Americans, or what you would call the Israel lobby, meaning including also evangelical Christians and others in this country with the centers of power, that emotional relationship with Israel have basically alienated any possibility of a balanced or an objective American view of the Palestinian issue, Palestinians as dispossessed Palestinians, as occupied Palestinians, as victims of Israeli occupation. So on these, on all three levels, I think, the Palestinians got a bad rap and Israel got more or less a positive rap. But you would think, after all these decades and after 20 years of failure of the peace process, as America loses more and more of its credibility and leverage in the region, that someone or someones will wake up and start writing a different kind of critique in the media. But unfortunately, it has not been forthcoming as you would expect it to.
Have you yourself, now living in Washington, I think, or I don't know if you're in New York or Washington, you know, kind of attracted flack?
I'm actually a citizen of the world, Danny.
I place myself
between London, Doha, and New York.
We won't pin you down to your location. But, I mean, have you encountered a kind of prejudice and flack yourself?
Well, actually, no, not per se, because I am, you know, I mean, for your viewers, and this is not something I usually cite or say so much of, but, you know, I did grow up in a Baptist school center convention in a Jewish state, speak Hebrew probably better than most people in this country, or than all people in this country. And I'm, you know, American educated and the likes, and in the end of the day, my identity is you know, multifaceted, and one major pillar of it is, of course, having grown and studied and learned and were groomed on, you know, American ideals. So, you know, I am one of those who is considered a student of American history and American values and so on and so forth, as much as I am on other, you know, values and traditions and so on and so forth. So I really don't have much of a problem, although you could say I don't necessarily feel at home in any which part, because basically I feel at home everywhere.
Well, Marwan Bishara, thank you so much for joining us on Media Channel Radio. You'll hear the conversation on mediachannel.org. We appreciate it. We just want to remind listeners again to see Marwan's program, Empire. You can see it online at aljazeera.com/empire. Thank you so much, Marwan, for bringing
us
your perspectives. And I think it's important for Americans and, you know, people around the world to understand and appreciate the fact that there are journalists there who are trying to tell the truth and tell the truth to power.
Thank you.
Well, there you go, Marwan Bishara on Media Channel Radio. Thank you so much. Of course, this has been also a big day with the government announcing plans anyway to kind of, shall we say, dilute the idea of network neutrality, which has been a principle at the FCC, certainly a goal of the media and democracy movement for a long time. Now with a new head of the FCC who comes out of the corporate world, we are getting new proposals for network neutrality, which bear little resemblance to network neutrality. So this is an issue that we are covering on mediachannel.org, and it's an issue that you have to deal with because it's going to lead to higher fees for your web services and an attempt to get you to upgrade to more expensive methods of access, with the companies making even more money and and people getting even fewer choices. So that's a concern for the future. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org and share your comments with me. The podcast of this program will be available on PRN FM. It will also be heard on mediachannel.org. We welcome your comments. We're trying to bring you perspectives about media from all voices and all places to the degree that we can, and we welcome suggestions for guests and issues that we might be able bring to your attention on the program in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, thank you so much again for listening to Media Channel Radio and being here on PRN FM.
I pledge allegiance to the card of the United States of Credit, one nation under debt.